production. Mark Randolph is best known as the co-founder and first CEO of Netflix. He laid much of the groundwork for a service that's grown to 150 million subscribers and fundamentally altered how the world experiences media. Mark is wise and infectiously curious about life. He says you're going to get things wrong. You just don't want to get the same thing wrong twice. In this heartfelt conversation, Mark and I discuss the story of Netflix, the importance of honesty, and turning dreams into reality.
Everyone has dreams in their head. Everyone has ideas. Everyone who's taken a shower has had an idea. So few people do something about it, and they go through their life with the dream in their head, or with the regret they didn't try it, or with this feeling that they've left something undone. My purpose was to unlock that.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Mark Randolph is the author of the best-selling book That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. In this conversation, you will learn how to make your impossible vision a reality. Mark, you have had an amazing life, but I would love to know about your upbringing.
It was actually pretty interesting when you think about how where it led in terms of kind of a career as an entrepreneur, also known as a guy who couldn't really hold down a regular job. It's more that my parents were pretty encouraging of risk-taking. If I have to look back at the one thing that was the most deterministic, I guess. In fact, you know, it was the sort of thing where if I said, hey, guess what? I'm going to go caving this weekend. Whereas most parents would have said, are you out of your mind? You're going to get killed. What are you doing? You know, they were the ones who said, oh, that sounds really great. You should try that. One time, do you know what rappelling is? Where you kind of slide down a rope, down a cliff?
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to teach myself rappelling, and I told my dad I wanted to learn to rappel, and I was going to rappel off one of the branches of the trees in the backyard. And he said, well, there's a rope out in the garage. Like, that's the kind of attitude they had. And pretty much that is what an entrepreneur does, is thinks, I want to try something, and then just does it. And certainly they set it up very early on. The other thing is that if I ever wanted to learn something, I was expected to teach myself. So there were not fancy lessons. There was always, well, go to the library. And I pretty much learned early on that if I wanted to do something, I should just do it.
Yes.
That I shouldn't necessarily wait for instruction or wait for an expert or wait for an official opinion, but that I could learn pretty well by going in and making mistakes.
What made you so curious to learn?
You know, I don't know where that comes from. I think curiosity, though, is a big part of me.
Yes.
I go deep on things when I'm curious about them. You know, at one point, I got really interested in coffee. And wow, did I go down a rabbit hole with that one, with the whole biochemistry of coffee and the tweaking and doing all these home modifications on the espresso machine and timing and measurement. But it was fascinating. And you know, as you probably know, I have a podcast. I didn't know anything about podcasting. And I said, I'm going to figure this out, and just began doing calls with people. And boy, do you learn quickly that way.
Yes.
And the same thing, almost everything I've tried to do that I'm curious about, I just want to learn it all. When I was doing keynote speaking for the first time, I purposely did not get a booking agent or a speaker's bureau. I said, I'm going to do this all myself because I really want to understand how it works. What are the motivations? What are all the ways people take advantage of speakers? What are all the things you have to watch out for? And I got taken advantage of a lot, and I had a lot of things go wrong. But then a year later, I went, okay, now I really understand why you need a speakers bureau. And then I knew what to ask for and how to have the right relationship with them.
Did your parents push you academically at all? And did you do well at school?
No, I was a pretty mediocre student. Mm. I was one of those people that it came pretty easily to me. And rather than converting that into excellence, I basically converted it into what's the least amount that I can do and still get by. And so I can kind of pursue my other passions. So I wasn't a great student. I wasn't a terrible student. I think my mom made one good run at trying to push me. Our middle school, which is in the United States, would be when you're maybe 12, 13, 14, something like that. That's when you first begin having the academic paths diverge, and you have some kids who are on the honors track, which is the harder classes. And I didn't make the honors track, and my mother would hear nothing of that. And so she went in and she spoke to the principal of the school and she spoke to the teachers, and I ended up on the honors track. But sorry, Mom, I still got B's and C's.
I'm sure she's very proud of you now. How did you find yourself begging for money at the age of 21?
Yeah, that was an interesting experiment. I'm a big outdoors person, and the summer jobs that I had starting in high school and all the way through university was I was leading outdoor trips in the mountains of the American West, and they're pretty aggressive. And I would do that for 2 months each summer. 1 month each summer, I would work for a different program, which was a program which worked with adjudicated youth, is the expression. Informally, we called it hoods in the woods, where you take people who were from urban backgrounds who had been in trouble in some way, and you bring them backpacking and camping and canoeing, and essentially you stress them. And you're trying to demonstrate to them that all these things that they think are impossible, there's no way I can do that, that you show them you can do it. And you're trying to translate that back to the stresses of all the things they go, I can't do that in the regular life. Reasonable objective and actually fairly effective. So to train the staff, they wanted us to experience in some way this sense of dislocation these urban kids had being in the woods. And of course, we're totally confident in the woods. So to get that dislocation, they flip the script on us, which is how I ended up being pushed out of a van at 11 o'clock in the morning in the middle of Hartford, Connecticut, with no wallet, no watch, no ID, with a promise they'll come and pick me up in 3 days. Wow. And then I would have to do a urban immersion, as they called it, which meant I had to figure out how to survive in the urban wild.
How did you survive?
Well, at first it was kind of fun, you know, but of course, being 21, you basically need to pretty much be continually shoveling food into your mouth. And I began getting pretty hungry. And so the initial way that I solved that problem, with no money, of course, was I would go to the food court, you know, the place in the mall where all the different little fast food restaurants are, and I would hover until I saw someone get up from their plate with half-eaten food on it and leave without bussing their tray. And then, like a seagull, I would swoop in and finish what was on the plate, which is kind of disgusting to think about that now, but you do what you have to do. And then I decided, all right, I'm going to cut out the middleman here. I'll just get some money and buy my own food. Can I get a job? And I said, I'm just going to panhandle. How hard could that be? And the answer, of course, is really hard. That act of going up to someone and putting out your hand and asking for money with nothing to give is just incredibly crushing. And it was really, really hard for me. I mean, it took me hours to kind of even get the nerve to do it the first time. But then, remember, we were talking a moment ago about learning by doing.
Yes.
And I go, I'm hungry. And you keep doing it and you keep doing it. And you begin to learn what works and what doesn't work, how to get the confidence, what to say, how to look someone in the eye or not look them in the eye. But what was really remarkable is that what worked for me was this complete emotional honesty, was not trying to bullshit somebody with, I lost my wallet or, you know, I was robbed or something. I would just walk up to people and say, can you spare some change? Because I'm really hungry. And they could see it in my face and they could hear it in my voice. And that lesson about sincerity in the ask was a remarkably powerful lesson for me, and one that I've, you know, used the rest of my life. And as you can imagine, one of the big job responsibilities of an entrepreneur is to beg for money and to frequently do so with nothing to give them in return. And what I kind of learned that after you've asked someone for 25 cents on the street with your hand out, that asking a venture capitalist for $50,000 is pretty easy.
What an amazing lesson. And who would have thought you would to learn that at such a young age? What did you learn about human nature from that experience?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's a lesson that has been reinforced over and over and over again, which is that people are basically good, that people want to help. People at their heart want to connect with people. And I think that's why the sincerity works, is because there's a cynicism which creeps in that this person's going to swindle me or this person's going to hurt me. And you begin to realize that a trust is an amazingly powerful, powerful thing. And I have so many good stories about that, but it's the difference between, my first part of my career, I was in direct marketing. I was a junk mail person. I did magazines and catalogs. And we did a program at one of the companies I worked at where you had a special price if you owned a previous version of this product. And when I came in to run the direct marketing program for this company, that whenever you wanted to get the special price, you almost had to send in your firstborn child. I mean, you had to go find the old product, take a photo of it, have it notarized, get six witnesses. I mean, it was ridiculous. And of course, they didn't sell anything. And I said, let's just trust people that if they say they're eligible for this, they're eligible for this. And there's a way of validating it on the back end, but you don't need to. And it turns out to be a really powerful lesson in life and in business that most people will do the right thing. And it's way better to open yourself up to being taken advantage of, because the things that you get from all the people that aren't going to take advantage of you is so much more powerful than the downside of the one or two people who do.
That's so unbelievably true. And you talk about knowing how to be a good leader by doing all this stuff in your youth. How important is it to be a trustworthy leader?
Leadership is so personal that the most important thing you can be as a leader is genuine. And I know plenty of leaders who are complete dicks, and it seems to work, and that's fine, but it's not my style. And my style has always been kind of a radical honesty. I just think that's just so much more effective. Life is too short to mince words or to be avoiding hurting feelings by evading the truth. And it doesn't necessarily make things easy. Sometimes you have to deliver very hard truths to people, but people want to hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, and a classic example is when someone is not performing in the workplace. And so many companies have this thing, performance improvement plan, I think is the euphemism for it, where basically we're going to write down the things you need to work on, and we're going to check in, you're going to have 6 months, and oh my God, it is cruel and unusual punishment, and it should be banned under the Geneva Convention. Because you know this person's not going to make it. The person knows they're not going to make it. What you're doing is going through this kabuki theater for 6 months to document why you have to fire them. It's so much more respectful of the person to tell them this is not working out. Mm. You know that it's not working out. We know that it's not working out. You're not a bad person. You're very talented, but your talents aren't what we need, aren't the same talents we need right now. Let's help you find some better place to work. And I'm not saying that doesn't hurt or sting, but afterwards, the respect you get for having been honest with someone goes such a long way.
I absolutely agree. And the leaders that I've had in my life who I absolutely respect and have worked best under are the ones that have been unbelievably honest. And that ends up making you work harder as well as enjoying the job a lot more. So, I, you know, why wouldn't you be that? And I know there's one thing that you say is that words and actions, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? How important is it if you're going to talk about something to actually have that take place rather than just say it and then it never happens?
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic. Everyone talks about culture these days, how important culture is. And so what people tend to think culture is what I write down. Let's design how we want the culture to be. But culture is not what you say. It's not what you write. It's not what you, I don't know, carve in the cornerstone of the building. Culture is what you do. Mm. It's how you treat people. It's how you talk to your co-founders or your employees. People see that, and that's where culture comes from. And the worst thing is when people say one thing, as you mentioned, and do another, where they have this expression, we don't tolerate, no assholes here. We don't tolerate that. Except, of course, if this person's really high performing and is our top sales guy, then the fact that he's an abusive jerk is fine. Mm. And then everyone just goes, okay, I get it. And the same thing, you know, again, we're talking about people who are not performing in the workplace. You go through this whole thing about everything is fine. And people are going, wait, what are you talking about? We can see this person is not doing a good job. So either Mark is stupid because he doesn't see it, or Mark is weak and he won't do anything about it. But you're right. Culture, it all comes down from basically walking the walk. And that's where you really, it's what really separates the companies who have sincere cultures from those who are just pretenders.
Yes, absolutely. Mark, you are the founder of Netflix, and we need to touch on this story because before I got asked to interview you, I thought Netflix was the Netflix that it is today, and then I started doing research and realized that was not the case. Can you tell us how Netflix came about?
So, like most startups, this one came from unusual circumstances. In this case, I was being fired, but not in a bad way. I was being fired because the company I was working for, a company which had been founded and was being run by another gentleman named Reed Hastings, and was being acquired by a bigger company. We were both going to be losing our jobs. We were being made redundant, as they euphemistically put it. And Reed was going to go back to school, get a higher degree in education. I was going to start another company because Netflix was number six. And the question is what? And Reed wanted to kind of keep a hand in the startup world, and he was going to be my angel investor. So we began brainstorming ideas for this next company. And this is not like we're movie buffs. I mean, my kids were like 1, 3, and 5. So basically 80% of my movie consumption was The Lion King, with Aladdin thrown in as the other 20%. But the things, because of my direct marketing background, I knew this was going to be an e-commerce company selling something on the internet. And I wanted it to have some personalization. So I was pitching Reed, commuting back and forth to work. I was pitching him ideas like, oh, this is a real one. It was personalized shampoo. And I said, no, Reed, really, it's a great idea. People will cut off a lock of their hair and they'll mail it to us, and we'll have a lab full of hair scientists who formulate custom blends, and they subscribe to it. And he shot all kinds of holes in that one. So I said, okay, next day, another idea in the car. Reed, personalized dog food. It's a custom blend for your breed, the dog's breed, its age, its activity level, the climate, I don't know. Didn't like that. And the next day we pitched video rental by mail. And video rental, of course, back then, this is 1996, came on VHS cassettes. So that idea went out the window because those are too big and heavy. But the breakthrough was this technology that Reed heard about in test market called the DVD. And so we thought, wow, this actually might re-energize that video rental by mail idea. And so we did this critical thing that entrepreneurs do, which is not drive to the office and write a business plan, is not going home and working on a pitch deck or applying for Shark Tank or something like that. It was figuring out immediately, let's collide this idea with some reality. And so mid commute to work, we turned the car around and went back to town where we lived to buy a DVD and couldn't find one, and decided to settle for a music CD. And we mailed that to our Reed's house in town. And the next day when he picked me up to drive to work, he had a little envelope with an unbroken CD in it. And that was the moment where we said, this actually might work. And then Reed wrote a check for $2 million. And I hired a dozen people, got a little office, spent 6 months building a terrible little website, got a copy of every DVD available at the time, all 970 titles. And on April 14th, 1998, boom, we launched that little company, now known as Netflix. And so, as you said, the Netflix that you're familiar with in Australia is unrelated in many ways to the Netflix back then, because then it was DVDs only, no streaming. If you wanted a movie, we mailed it to you in a little red envelope. And there was due dates and late fees, so you had to then mail it back. And, you know, my book is called That Will Never Work, because that is what everyone told me when I pitched this idea of video rental by mail. It's what my employees, my investors, my wife said that. And they were right. It didn't work. It was a terrible idea. No one rented from us. And thus began a year and a half saga of trying every possible thing we could think of to figure out how to make DVD rental by mail work.
How did it go from that, DVD by mail, to the amazing streaming service it is today?
So when people said, told me that will never work, they had two objections. And the first one was Blockbuster, which was, for those of you who are any younger than 25, probably never heard of that. It's a store where you could rent movies. No, there was 9,000 Blockbuster stores. And so everyone said, why would anybody do mail order video rental when you just go to a Blockbuster? But the other big objection was they go to DVDs digital. It's just a matter of, I don't know, weeks, months before everyone is downloading it or streaming it. And then you're gone. And they were sort of right. They were wrong about the timeline. We knew this was going to take a long time for there to be the ability to actually stream movies. But they were right that it was inevitable. And so at the very beginning, from day one, from day negative 180, we knew that there was going to be this big transformation at some point in the future. And that if we built the company around DVDs, if our advertising was the fastest plastic shippers in the world, we could do well for a bunch of years, but then that wouldn't mean anything. But if we had started on day one and said, we are all about downloading movies or streaming movies, we couldn't have delivered on that. So the trick was to position the company in a way that was independent, that was delivery agnostic. And so one of the smartest things we did was say, this company doesn't stand for plastic or streaming. It stands for helping people discover great stories. And began on day one making that real by having all 970 available DVDs. It then meant this huge investment in the editorial content to help you discover great stories. Mm. It went all the technology and doing the taste matching that we learned how to do. And all of those things were put in place so that when it was possible to stream, no one thought twice about the fact that they were now getting it over a wire rather than, or through the air rather than in their mailbox. They all had a relationship with a company that stood for something else. And so, yes, that's how it went from one to the other. At the very beginning, it was always about discovering great stories. But for the first, 9 years, 1998 to 2007, the only way you could discover a great story was have us mail it to you. But then we've been streaming now for 14 years.
Wow.
Finally getting good at it.
Very good at it. When was the moment when you were at Netflix, do you remember it, where you sat down or maybe you were standing up and you thought, God, we've made it?
I can answer that two ways. The first one is that for an entrepreneur, you learn to squash that feeling because it almost always leads to a bus hitting you from the side. But the funny thing is, there was a moment when I said, oh my God, we've made it. And it was, I was reading the New York Times, the newspaper of record in the United States, probably in the world. I was doing the crossword puzzle. And one of the clues was service with a Q. And I went, oh my God. And it was Netflix was the answer. And I could not believe that this ridiculous idea that everyone said will never work was successful enough that it had become a clue, an answer to a clue in the New York Times crossword
puzzle. That is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. You've mentioned a few times your wife didn't think it would work. So many other people didn't think it would work. And I mean, there are so many people out there that do try ideas, but they get overwhelmed by the comments from other people. And maybe a lot of the time it's people that they respect and trust saying that it won't work. How do you push past that to keep on going?
It's probably the most important skill of an entrepreneur. It's the thing that stops the most people. You know, on my podcast, I'm not interviewing celebrities or big entrepreneurs. I'm mentoring and coaching real people with real business problems. And so many of them have that exact same business problem that everyone is saying, your idea is no good. That will never work. And we have all had that experience where you wake up with the amazing idea and you come running downstairs and you tell your spouse or you tell your boss and they say that'll never work. But the real answer is that no one knows anything. There is absolutely no way to know in advance whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. In fact, I've learned even more cynically, there's no such thing as a good idea. No ideas are good ideas. And the only way you're going to find out whether your idea is any good is to try it. Mm. And you have to take that step. And so what I'm trying to train people to do, what I'm working with them, what I'm encouraging them to do is how do I take that next step? It is easier than most people think. So many people, even on the podcast, come in and say, how do I find a technical co-founder? How do I raise money? How do I build an app? And I go, whoa, back up here. Let's think of a much simpler way to figure out if your idea is a good one or not. That doesn't involve building something or hiring someone or doing an app. Let's figure out a way to today collide your idea with reality and start that process of realizing why your idea is a bad one. And I know it's a bad one, but I've been hearing it. They're all bad ones. But it's, you've got to take that first step and collide it with the reality to start figuring out why is it a bad one. And it's amazing what happens is you collide it and you go, oh, that didn't work, but whoa, look what happened over here. And that, then you go down that direction and then this direction. And that it's that jumping from stepping stone to stepping stone that is not only what leads to success in starting a business, but that's where the fun is. Mm. That is the most unbelievably exciting voyage of discovery you could ever have. And I'm trying to just to get people to let's go.
Yes.
Stop. The dreaming is fun. We all love, oh, I've got this great idea. How have you been working on it? Oh, I've been dreaming about it for 8 years. It's amazing. Just think, when we have 200 million users, how powerful this will be. Yeah, great. It's a castle in your mind. And by now, to make your castle real, you know, it's huge. You can't build that. So knock it all down and let's just do something real.
How important is it for people to get their dreams out of their head and actually put them into reality? Because I think that is where a lot of people get very stuck.
It's the only thing. Mm. It's worthless in your head. It's what separates the people. That's what entrepreneurs do, is they have a predisposition to action. They think less, they do more. It is just like Reed and I, who are driving to work, and have the idea that maybe DVD will re-energize his idea, and didn't even think about it. We'd like, you know, almost cause a traffic accident. We turned that car around so fast to go back and immediately find out whether this idea is ridiculous. Because it could have been, we go to the post office and they go, that'll be $1. Well, that wouldn't work. Mm. It has to go at the first class rate. Oh, or it gets to Reed's house, broken. But we found that out in one day. And I don't know if we have time. Can I tell a really quick story
Absolutely.
Of how this might be in practice for somebody? And I'm going to use an example. This is someone who I worked with on the podcast. And she was a university student, has an idea. And the idea is to do peer-to-peer clothing rental. Fancy way of saying, I've got a closet full of clothes that I don't wear all the time. I know my friends do too. Let's have an app that allows us to see each other's clothes and rent them from each other. Great idea or terrible idea. Who knows? And she was coming to me for advice that all young entrepreneurs do is, how do I raise money? Where do I find my technical co-founder, et cetera? And I said, back up. Do you have a piece of paper? Yes. Do you have a Sharpie, a pen? She goes, yes, I have that. I go, do you have a piece of tape? I go, she goes, great. Write on the piece of paper, if you want to borrow clothes, knock. And tape it to your door right now. And let's find out in the next few hours what happens. Now, it could be you go 24 hours and no one knocks. Well, then you've learned something right there. Or even better, someone knocks and now you're going to find out about problems with fit or problems of taste. Or even better, people like and it fits. Now you're going to find out how you feel when your nice blouse comes back with a big stain on it. And then you're going to learn about how to factor in dry cleaning costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you're going to do all of that learning with a piece of paper and a Sharpie and a piece of tape. And you're going to do that in the next 2 weeks rather than the next 2 years of putting together a big business plan and an app and wasting all this time and all this money. That's the cleverness, is how do I figure out a quick and easy and cheap way to take this idea and immediately get it out of my head and begin to figure out, is this going to work or not?
That's an amazing story. How did she go?
Oh, it was fantastic, because of course it does work,
yeah.
But it ends up being something totally different than what you imagined. No idea ever survives into adulthood looking the way it does like a child. Mm. It's that process. In fact, I've never met a company there's all the apocryphal stories, but that they started with, but they didn't. They start out with stupid things like mailing discs in the mail with due dates and late fees. But it's only by struggling and solving and trying that you get where you have to be. And the same thing with this young woman.
Yeah.
She eventually did launch a version of this, but it had to change. It had to be modified to actually work, because the idea in her head, of course,
yeah,
it was flawed.
Mark, you say your dad actually used to say, the only way out is through. And it reminds me actually of the Winston Churchill quote, if you're going through hell, keep going. How have you used that in your everyday life?
I know that one of the problem-solving traps you fall into is this circular trap where you go, oh, this doesn't work. So, but oh, this might, cause this, and you do this. Oh, this has worked. This might. And you, and all three of them keep leading to each other in this endless circle because none of them really solve the problem. Or put a different way, people kind of want to believe there's a magic solution sometimes to problems. So the classic problem in my past to this was certainly when we were in big trouble about 2.5 years into Netflix and decided that the only way out was going to be to sell to Blockbuster. And it took us a long time to get the meeting. And we finally flew to Dallas, Texas, and we pitched Blockbuster to buy the company. And it was going great. And then they asked how much they should pay for us. And I was there with Reed Hastings, my co-founder, and he said, you know, $50 million. And they laughed. And that was the end of that. And that was this moment where I was crushed because I thought this was going to solve the problem. This was the magic bullet. This was, as they, you know, say in the movies, the Deus Ex Machina, where the heroes are trapped in the canyon. There's no way out. And they're surrounded by the enemy. And at the last minute, down comes the amazing miracle and plucks them to safety. And we thought that Blockbuster was going to be that miracle. And when it wasn't, it was that realization that, as you said, and my dad said, that sometimes the only way out is through, that there is no way you're going to save yourself. That's going to be some magic that you're going to have to fight back. And that in this case, that we were not only going to not be saved by Blockbuster, we had to compete with them. And we plunged headfirst into this long, long, long battle with Blockbuster.
Sometimes you have to give up something great for something greater to come in. And I've just had it in my life where I've been doing something amazing and I felt it was time to then give it up to be able to open myself up to something more incredible. It's a scary, scary thing to give up something good for something greater. When have you done that in your life?
This was reasonably early at Netflix. And I mentioned before that Reed Hastings is my co-founder. He wasn't day-to-day involved in the company. I was the CEO. He was my board chair and biggest investor. But he was intellectually involved, and he would stop by on his way home in the evening, and we'd chat a lot. And then one day he poked his head in and said, "Mark, we've got to talk." And as anyone who's ever heard those words delivered, you know that that is not a promising beginning to a conversation. And it turns out that Reed was concerned about the direction of the company, and more specifically, concerned about my leadership, about my judgment. And he wasn't seeing things right then that were catastrophic. I was doing fine. But he was seeing issues that he knew would become a problem as the company got bigger, as our velocity increased, as our competition became more intense. And what was especially hard is that Reed and I have had one of those honest relationships that you and I were talking about before, where we never minced words with each other. There was never ulterior motives. We trusted each other to tell each other the truth. And I had so much respect for Reed that when he was telling me he saw issues with me as a leader, I knew I couldn't dismiss this, that there was truth there. And at first I thought he was going to fire me. You know, he had more stock than I did. But what I realized after the conversation went on is that Reed was saying something very different. What he was really saying is we should run the company together, that he would come in and join the company full-time as the CEO. I would slide over and become president, and we'd do it together. And it was, that was a interesting conversation because, you know, I have always, when I started the company, I had this dream. And it was the dream that most CEOs have of being the leader of this huge, successful company. But as I sat about Reed's thought about Reed's conversation, I realized that there really were two different dreams. There was the dream of me being the leader, and there was the dream of the big successful company, and that they really were separate. And even more importantly, the dream of the successful company wasn't just my dream anymore. It was the dream of my employees. It was the dream of my investors. It was the dream in some way of my customers. And I realized that, what did I think I should do if the two dreams in some ways collided with each other? And it was not an easy decision. I mean, it took a lot of wine on the porch with my wife, talking this, about this and thinking about this. And ultimately, I had to agree that Reed was right, that the company would be stronger with us running it together. It would be more likely to be successful with him as CEO and me as the president. And Reed joined the company. I stepped over. And as I look back, of all the decisions I ever had to make at Netflix, either before that moment or after that moment, that was probably the best decision I ever made. Because in many ways, after that moment when Reed joined the company full time, was the renaissance at Netflix. So many of the fundamental innovations that transformed that company and still guide it today happened when we were doing it together. And then certainly if you look at Reed's leadership since I left, remarkable.
Yeah.
So yes, I stepped away from something that was important to me, but something much, much greater came of that.
Mark, how did you manage your ego and your sore heart when he said that to you that day?
Well, part of it, I was 40 at the time, and that helps. But, you know, we spoke earlier, I think, about honesty. Mm. And that's not bullshit. That, you know, that's either you either apply, have that or you don't have that. And honesty doesn't necessarily just mean what you tell other people. Honesty is also what you tell yourself. Mm. And, you know, I wrote That Will Never Work 16 years after I left Netflix. And a lot of it was being able to look back at it and be able to be very, very honest with myself. What was I good at? What was I not good at? And that's such a valuable thing to be able to do. So, yeah, like I said, it wasn't easy. It wasn't like, okay, good idea. You know, it took a little bit and it took some adjustment. But fundamentally, never looked back.
How important do you think it is to have purpose in your life and to be of service for the right reason?
It's very, very important. But I have not realized that until late in my life. but it's actually a kind of funny story. I was invited by Richard Branson to come hang out on his private island for 4 days. And we'd party, we would go kite surfing, we'd lie on the beach, my wife and I. And I, of course, said no. And that lasted until I told my wife that decision. And then pretty soon I was canceling my boys' mountain biking weekend and we were stocking up on sunscreen. But it was not an all fun and games thing. I was going to be going to Necker Island, his island, mm-hmm. because I was going to speak for 40 minutes at a conference about finding purpose. And I said, okay, to my wife, this is not bad. I'll go, I'll do my gig, and then we'll lie on the beach for the next 3 days. And after I got up and gave my little presentation about how to turn dreams into reality, using all the entrepreneurial techniques that I know, I decided I'm going to stick around and see what this finding your purpose thing is all about. And after the first speaker, I was hooked. It was like they were speaking directly to me. And what I'd realized is I have all this experience. I have 35 years as an entrepreneur, I've learned all these tips and tricks and secrets about how to take ideas out of your head and make them real. I can go show up to do a keynote and 10,000 people will sit there and listen to me for an hour. But what's the point? How do I use that? What do I do with that? What is my purpose? So I think about it all the time. And what I decided was fairly simple, is that everyone has dreams in their head. Everyone has ideas. Everyone who's taken a shower has had an idea. And so few people do something about it, and they go through their life with the dream in their head, or with the regret they didn't try it, or with this feeling that they've left something undone. And that my purpose was to unlock that, to give people the support, or give them the nudge, or give them the encouragement, or sometimes give them the tough love to help them get either the idea out of their head, or get the business just flailing on track, or turn the side hustle into a real company, or turn the real company into a bigger success. That was what my purpose was. And that was why I went back and I wrote the book, which was not just to tell the untold stories of Netflix, but to reveal those tips and tricks and secrets that aren't just for business. They're for anybody who has an idea they want to make real. It's why I'm doing the podcast, which is why I'm not interviewing big, successful entrepreneurs, but spending time talking to real people who are struggling with real business issues and trying to give them, like I said, the encouragement or the tough love or the tips, the techniques that they can use to unlock something.
Mark, when you think of your success at Netflix and everything you've achieved, do you think it's more than luck and hard work?
There's three things. So a huge piece of it is luck. Huge piece of it is luck. So much of the fact that you and I are speaking today is survivor bias. And so many things had to go right, and they did. I've been remarkably lucky in how things have turned for me. The second thing is I do work hard. And I have learned how to work smart, because I do want balance in my life. So I do not work like a crazy man. You know, I go home at reasonable hours. I only work a limited number of days a week. So there are the third thing that I have is I realized something really early in my life. It was these two critical things. And I learned what I'm good at, and I learned what I love. And the biggest piece of luck is that they were both the same thing. It was all this early stage company. And that's what gave me the passion and the commitment and the joy of doing what I do, is that I love it. It's not work. It's the solving the most fun puzzle you could ever solve. And here's a modesty warning. I'm pretty good at it. I do have a pretty good innate sense of what to focus on. I'm really good at triage. I'm a reasonably good leader. But it's more this realization that I've found something that I love doing. That combined with the hard work, that combined with the luck, has brought me more success than I deserve.
You've obviously done well financially through your life. Has that made you happier?
No, not really. There are different axes. I was pretty fortunate in that I grew up in a pretty wealthy community. And I say fortunate, not because we had a nice house, but fortunate because I saw how miserable so many of my parents' friends were, who were extremely wealthy and extremely powerful, but miserable, divorcing, their kids wouldn't speak to them. And it wasn't a overt lesson. It was a subtle lesson that I never formed that connection. This unreasonable aspiration that, oh, if only I was rich, I'll be happy. And so my philosophy has always been that there are two separate axes. that happiness can be is on one axis and wealth is on another one. And listen, all things being equal, there is a lot of wonderful things that come with having economic resources. I don't need to worry about paying for my kids' education. I don't struggle to pay for health care. I don't worry about whether I can put food on the table. But once you get beyond that, not a lot. It's not a big motivator for me.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Relax. You know, I try and pay that one forward too. But when I was about 29, so pretty late, an executive at a company that I was working at said, "Mark, how old are you?" And I told him, and he goes, "Oh, okay, that explains it." He goes, "That franticness, just relax, it's going to come." And what he meant, of course, is that this sense of what am I doing? Where am I going? Why don't I see this clear path of what my future holds would sort itself out. Mm. And it did. You know, I did find this passion of what I love doing. It happened right around that age. And now I see young people, I see my own kids, I see my kids' friends who are struggling because they're 24 and haven't yet got it all figured out. And I'm going, gosh, relax, you know, take some risks, explore. There's plenty of time.
What's your greatest hope for society today?
Oh, well, I don't want the polarization to tear us apart. We are so much more alike than we are different. And it really terrifies me the way that we are being driven into separate camps. You look at in my own country, how it's this terrible polarization between left and right. But if you took two Americans and brought them to a footy game and sat them next to each other, they would find so much more in common with each other than they ever believed. And if you take an American and an Australian and you brought them somewhere else in the world, they would find unbelievable connections that we still have because we sprang from the same country 250 some odd years ago. I mean, that's my hope, is that I don't want to lose that.
What's the lesson that has taken you the longest to learn?
Trust my judgment in people. But my judgment in people took a while for me to get confidence that if I thought someone was nice or great, they would probably worry even though they were acting strangely, and vice versa. If somebody was a real jerk but everyone else seemed to like them, that no, I should trust my judgment.
What is a life of greatness to you?
If you can do the thing that you love, if you can do the things that you're good at, and if you can combine that into a balanced life where you have your intellectual pursuits, you have your friends and your family, and you have the other activities that make you whole, which for me is like outdoor stuff, then you are the most successful person I could ever imagine.
Mark Randolph, thank you so much for the inspiring conversation today. I am so grateful.
Thank you very much. This was really a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers Matt Curry and Nicola Sitch. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now, and listen for free. Listener.